Chapter the Third. That evening, in my customary guise as Dr. Rogostin's secretary, Ivy Meshel, I went home to my rented lodging and shared a less than satisfactory supper of carrots and kidneys with my elderly landlady. Since Mrs. Tupper is as deaf as a cast-iron gatepost, I attempted no conversation while we ate. But afterward, I signalled her that I wished to borrow some reading material from her. That is to say, I spread my hands as if opening a newspaper, then pointed upward towards her bedchamber. There were only three rooms in her East End hovel, mine, hers, and the single cooking-dining sitting-room on the ground floor. Still, the sweet old soul did not understand. Placing her trumpet to her ear, she leaned towards me over the table and bellowed, "What? You say there's a bat got in upstairs?" Eventually, I had to lead her upstairs to show her what I wanted, her stacks of society periodicals. As a step towards finding and helping Lady Cecily, I hoped to discover the identity of the ogresses in whose dubious company I had seen her. Society watching was a pursuit that, being a person of democratic convictions, I had scorned up until now, so I had a great deal of catching up to do. After carrying Mrs. Tupper's accumulated periodicals to my own room, gladly I rid myself not only of my dress, but my bust enhancer, hip regulators and corset, my cheek and nostril inserts, my fringe of curls, and my false eyelashes, making myself comfortable in a dressing gown and slippers before settling down to read. Although I cannot say I particularly enjoyed it. Over the course of the next several hours, I learned that croquet was quite passé, tennis and archery still in mode, but the very latest sport for ladies was golf. Lord Juggears and Lady Parsnipface had been seen coaching in Hyde Park. She wore a Worth gown of ciel-blue French gibberish moire. What a shame that Kensington Palace stood empty despite its restoration. A most distinguished gathering had attended the christening of baby so-and-so, first-born son of Lord Suchamuch, Earl of What Does It Matter. Satin was out, peau de soie in. An oil-painting exhibition themed around the progress of the British Empire was viewable at gallery ever so exclusive. Viscount and Viscountess Ancient Lineage announced the engagement of their daughter Long Name to Great Prospects, the younger son of Earl Blueblood. My head ached abominably. I thought I should go quite mad, and I had not yet looked through even a quarter of the stack. I peered at photographs of Duchess Duckfoot's boating party, Baron Bulbnose's cricket team's annual banquet, debutante Wasp Waist's coming-out ball, and dozens more, without finding either of the two unpleasant faces I sought. When day turned to dark, gladly I rose from my chair, for I would strain my eyes if I attempted to read any longer by candlelight. From its hiding-place between mattress and bedstead, I pulled the dark, decrepit clothing I wore when I went out to wander the night. Now that winter had passed, poor folk living in the streets were less in need of my help, and since my brother Sherlock knew of my work as the Sister of Charity, I had been obliged to discard my black habit with deep pockets. While I still managed to slip pennies to the unfortunate, I had found another guise in which to roam London in the dark hours. I went as a midden picker. That is, one who scavenges garbage heaps for bits of rag for the paper mills, bone for garden meal, metal for the smelters, or food, definitely not for me. I wore a shabby skirt and shawl, walked with a rickety, shambling gait, and carried a battered lantern in one hand and a burlap sack upon my bent back. Some innate unrest drives me to roam the night in any event, but in settling upon this particular guise, I gave myself a purpose. I wanted to learn my way around all of London, not just the East End. As a midden picker, I could go anywhere without interference, for I exemplified thriftiness. Although propriety dictated that such an unsightly scavenger must steal in and out again by night, still, only the most mean and stingy of households would drive such a hard-working representative of the deserving poor from their premises. Whether Mrs. Tupper was asleep yet or not, there was no fear that the dear deaf soul would hear me go out. Latching the door behind me, I made my way into the crowded street. In the warm months, the narrow lanes of the slums thronged even at midnight. Arm in arm, a clot of men staggered past, singing a drunken song. On one corner, by the light of the street lamp, haggard women sewed sacks for flour and such, piecework to bring in a few farthings, until their hands and eyes could labour no more. On another corner loitered other women, showing a great deal of bosom and ankle, also at work, but not sewing. Everywhere children meandered aimlessly. It sometimes seemed to me that half the population of London was children, and half the children were orphans. It was very much the usual thing for a girl of the slums to have a baby by the time she was 15, then die in her 20s, whilst the other half were Hansels and Gretels, turned out by parents who could not feed them. This was East London. 10 minutes on the Underground took me to West London, which might as well have been a different world. Especially the neighbourhood where I went that night. Here square old houses slept, blanketed in ivy, surrounded by square fenced yards. Here streets ran wide and empty into yet more squares, cobbled squares. This area was like a great square patch brick and stone quilt I had not yet comprehended to my satisfaction. What sort of people lived here? In a square-towered Italianate villa, nouveau riche, or impoverished royalty? In a mansard-roofed French Second Empire edifice, maiden aunts or dilettantes? In a much-gabled Queen Anne, a doctor, a dandy? Gas lighted some of the houses, others stood dark. Ambling along, I saw no one except a pair of night-soil men making their rounds. While there might be water-closets within the houses, there were still back-garden privies that needed to be emptied, and this distasteful process had to be done by darkness. Hence the men with the great metal container on a cart. After the rumble of its wheels had faded away, although its fetter, alas, had not, I saw and heard no other persons, except, coming towards me, the measured pacing of a constable on his beat.
"Good evening, Dax," I piped as he approached me. "And many good evenings to yourself, dearie."
He was Irish and cheery, twirling his baton, nodding approval of my burlap sack.
"Me nose was telling me, afore them stinkers passed, that it's mock turtle soup they're after having at number 44."
"Thank you kindly."
Off I scuttled, lighting my sorry little lantern, and sure enough, in back of number 44, I found the skull of a calf's head they had boiled. One can hypothesize about people by their midden heaps. For instance, perhaps members of this household had aspirations that exceeded their means, as turtle soup, the genuine item, was all the rage among the rich. Once behind the houses, with the calf skull in my bag and the constable's friendliness bolstering my nerve, I zigzagged from backyard to backyard, entering mostly through carriage drives. From each carriage house a dog would bark in a perfunctory manner, to be shushed by the boy or groom sleeping in the loft overhead after he had taken a peep at me through his window. Thus admitted to the nether world of the neighbourhood, I started to sort out the inhabitants in my mind. Sometimes there were vegetable gardens tucked behind the carriage houses, where they could easily be enriched by manure and straw. Solid and sensible folk, these. Some houses seemed empty, perhaps waiting for an owner to return from abroad, but quite a few were occupied by families with children, as evidenced by hoops, brightly striped balls, clapping monkey pool toys, etc., left lying about. And someone had a seamstress living in, sewing the entire family new springtime outfits, for in the midden heap I found threads and scraps of everything from serge to taffeta, all of which I bagged by the light of my lantern. But at the next house, I saw, as I shuffled towards its back fence, I needed no lantern. For some reason these people kept gas jets flaring out of doors, like a modern sort of flambeau. How wasteful and how odd! The gate to the carriage drive was padlocked, but through the iron rails of the fence, and by the light of all those outdoor gas jets, I could see quite a pile of bones just past the corner of the carriage house. Once one begins collecting something, for whatever reason, the act becomes a sort of mania in itself. Even though at the night's end I would give away my finds to the first beggar I encountered, nevertheless, when I saw those bones, I had to have them. Forgetting that I was supposed to be a bent and rickety woman of the slums, I swarmed up and over the fence within a moment. I love to climb, and seldom get the chance, as this is not a pastime much pursued by proper females. Light-hearted as well as light-footed, I jumped down inside the fence and turned towards my objective. But I'd not gone three steps when a roar worthy of a Bengal tiger paralysed me. A huge animal charged me, bearing down on me like a galloping horse. Ye gods! I had not seen the doghouse tucked behind the carriage house, and now the proper owner of the bones, a massive mastiff, wished to tear my throat out. With no time to retreat over the fence, I was in a panic, fumbling for my dagger, when, quite unexpectedly, the beast halted, although it continued to roar and snarl at me in the most resounding and frightful manner. Whatever in the world? Why was I not being mauled? Then I saw. Oh, my goodness! The mastiff had halted on the far side of another inner fence, but not the usual sort of fence, unless I was much mistaken.
"What do you have there, Lucifer?"
drawled an insolent voice, and a massive man, rather resembling his mastiff, appeared from beneath beech trees and walked up on the far side of the inner fence. The sunk fence, so-called, also known as a ha-ha. A deep ditch lined with stone. Such modern moats were not uncommon around country estates, hidden in the contours of the land so as to preserve the integrity of the vista, whilst keeping out cattle and intruders. But here in the city? Whatever for?
A midden picker, the burly man was saying with disgust, eyeing me as if I were a cockroach to be crushed. How did you get in?
Making myself as small as possible, not difficult under the circumstances, I did not answer, only staring at the sunk fence with my mouth ajar.
"You don't know what it is, do you, bones for brains?"
I could hear the man sneer in his voice.
"It's a ha-ha. And do you know why it's called that, dust scholem? It's called that because when you fall in, we come and look at you, and we laugh. Ha, 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 ha."
Something in his tone of voice frightened me even more than the mastiff's barking did. I began to back away.
Ha, 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 ha.
I dodged into the shadows behind the carriage house out of his view and applied myself earnestly to climbing over the wrought iron fence.
"Ha, ha, and then we go away," he shouted after me, "and leave you there until you rot."
I was never in any danger, really, yet until I had got home again and lay safe in my bed, I could not stop trembling.